Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Mac, and you are listening to Mac's Musings. I am going to be dialing my guest here in a moment. If you bear with me, I will get that number in there and dial it. Hopefully everything will work. And my guest tonight is Darren Leung. And I probably pronounced it wrong, but he can pronounce it for us if I was wrong.
Hello.
Hello, Darren. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can.
Okay, good. That means we're on the air. Woohoo! How are you tonight?
Tired, but otherwise okay.
Aww.
How are you?
Oh, I'm okay. Yeah, because I caught you right after work, didn't I?
After work, just got in, wolfed down a few bites, but now I'm good.
Oh, well, thank you for doing this for me, and especially at that particular time where you had to wolf down some food. Okay, so we'll just get started, if that's okay.
Sure.
Now, you were born in Canada, and you were raised in the United States, and you were an engineer. So how did it all come about that you went from an engineer to working in the film business?
Let's see. So my parents are both from Hong Kong, and my father is the one I learned martial arts from. And so, as you know, there's a lot of, I guess you could say, a lot of the fight choreography that's in most movies these days has its roots more or less from Hong Kong cinema.
Right.
At least a lot of the big choreographers are from Hong Kong. So that, coupled with his martial arts background, is sort of like a mixture, you know, like, how do I put this? A lot of the stars and choreographers have a background in the martial arts that he does, and so using that network, he sort of got me into the door. And at the time, when I switched over from engineering, actually I had switched from material science engineering to IT, and then that was around the time the IT, the dot-com bubble burst. So I had been out of a job, and I said, well, let me, you know, burn some time, cool my heels out in Asia and see what you've been doing out there business-wise. And, you know, I've always been interested in film and that sort of thing, so I'd like to, you know, see if I can... You can get me in as, like, you know, a cameo or something, you know, just like a walk-on, like a waiter walking by, walking through the camera or something like that. But it turns out he had better connections than I realized, and he lined up a role in a Chinese TV series.
Oh, wow.
So that's what happened.
Wow. And so from that, you did a few more things, right? I mean, before you got into, like, doing stunts and everything, because you did a few things as an actor.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I think the first thing that I did for the camera was the TV series. I mean, discounting anything on stage, which is high school many years before that. But, I might have done, like, some industrial, you know, films. You know what I mean? Like a safety video, that sort of thing for commercial applications. And, you know, that's really nothing. You just dressed up and you point your finger or whatever you need to do. And that's your gig. But, yeah, the TV series thing was a whole other can of worms, because I had done a year of intensive Mandarin, well, relatively intensive. It was like a 6-credit course, so 2 6-credit semesters in college. But that was like a full 6 years before going to Asia, and then plop immersion in Shanghai for a crew that's 99% Mandarin speaking. So I arrived a month early with the pre-production crew and just went through the script, looked through all my parts and lines, and then just transcribed everything from Mandarin to English and Pinyin, so I made sure I knew what I was saying. And then after that, I was supposed, he actually knew, tangentially, he knew Wong Kar-wai, and he lined up a role because Wong Kar-wai eventually ended up doing the movie The Grandmasters. And that was about Yip Man, but I had not known at the time that the planning for Yip Man, or The Grandmasters, was already, it had already been in the cards for years. And I didn't realize Wong Kar-wai had a reputation for, you know, extending his productions for years on end. So I thought I was going to finish the TV series and then just do help out on that movie with training actors and Wing Chun, et cetera, and then maybe having a bit part in there, and I would be done. Little did I know that in the beginning of 2003, after finishing the TV series, I would have to wait until the end of 2008 before participating in The Grandmasters in any real capacity. Now, we did shoot a trailer at the end of 2002, Christmas of 2002. We went to Shanghai, and we shot like a teaser trailer thing for The Grandmasters. Well, what was to be The Grandmasters. And then basically nothing happened for me from 2003 until the end of 2008. But in the interim, I spent time training here, training there. I did four films for another guy. His name is Wu Mingtai. And he's part of the, you know Jackie Chan, you know Sammo Hung, right? So
yes.
They're part of this opera troupe, you know, the Peking sort of the stunt troupe that the in Chinese is called Tsutsu Fok. And he was sort of the most senior of them, but he only did a couple of movies when he was like a teenager or something like that. One of those movies was for King Hu, which is, I don't know, he had done some really classic Chinese martial arts movies. So this guy, really large guy, lots of character, he met up with my dad, and he's like, I like the cut of your jib, and sure, I'll put your son in a couple of movies, and sure enough, I did a couple of films for him. And then that was pretty much that.
Wow. Well, at least you were able to get somebody to help you out. Was that something that you always wanted to do, or it just, like, came along one day and you thought, I might as well go along with it? I mean, I know you said that you needed a job, but was being in the film business really a job that you thought you wanted, or you just did it because you needed a job?
No, I wanted just to get into it because it was fun. Like, now that I say that, I remember that my first real on-camera experience was with Jay Black. And Jay Black used to teach film at Regent University, and he was also one of our Kung Fu students. And he decided, you know, he put up money and shot a movie, a lot of which took place in our school. So using our school as a location, and, you know, we didn't, as far as I know, we certainly didn't charge him anything. So that's a huge bonus, as you know, for anybody making a film. So they painted the walls to make it look right and, you know, moved all the pictures so there weren't reflections and all that sort of good stuff. And then we sort of did our thing. And I had done two musical theater productions in high school, and I loved it. Just the whirlwind of activity and the practicing and all that stuff. But it was a different beast when I started doing Jay's movie because, you know, there was not very much rehearsal. You know, maybe some line reading and stuff like that, but then everything was so distinct, and then there was that, you know, it's like when you heat up a pot of water and all of a sudden it starts to boil. It's like the reverse of that, where everybody gets set up and then they roll the camera, and you could hear the camera roll, the film rolling away in the magazine, and it's just, it was so electric, you know. And, you know, it wasn't so much being in front of the camera that I liked, but the whole atmosphere, the whole production of it, you know, people doing makeup and hair and then the boom guys and the grips, every single person has his or her part. And I just fell in love with that. But I didn't pursue film as a career because I initially just wanted to come out to Asia because my father had spent so much time out there that I thought, well, maybe I could spend some time with him and, you know, two birds with one stone, and then also participate in some film as well as helping him with whatever business he was doing.
Well, there's this movie that a mutual friend of ours, Will Devakis, that he wanted me to ask you about because it never actually got made, The Perils of Posting. So he said you might want to talk about that for a little bit.
So that was originally was another Jay Black movie. And the first one that we did was called Stray, and I don't even remember what happened to that. I ended up getting a copy, and then years later, he decided to do The Perils of Posting, and I got a call back from him, and he said, yeah, let's do this thing, and we all shacked up in this erstwhile plantation out in, I think it was Suffolk or something like that, for, I'm going to say 2 weeks, like right around Valentine's Day, and everybody got acquainted. We did a table read, and the next day we're going to shoot. So we all came back for the shoot, and I think we shot one day, and then the next morning Jay had left. I don't know, because I think I caught that. I don't know if he caught how much of that he went over with you in his interview, because I didn't catch all of it.
Yeah, we didn't go over it a lot, but we did go over it a little bit.
Okay. So, yeah, Jay, as far as we knew, disappeared, but then we got the news that it was like a tragedy in his family, and he basically had to leave. And
right.
So that left his ex-wife, who was also part of production in another capacity, to take the reins. And so she was saddled with this tremendous responsibility of directing the whole thing and seeing it through to completion. But my understanding is she hadn't directed a film production before. And so you're short a man, the main man, and you're suddenly, you know, you have this thing foisted on you, and so she did the best that she could. Fortunately, the DP, I don't remember his name, but he's out of Detroit, and he was very experienced, so he helped, you know, set up a lot of the shots and just, you know, bang, 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 knocked a lot of setups out. But, you know, at that time, I'm trying to think. I don't even remember what year that was, but I want to say we had just finished the Grandmasters.
Oh, I don't know for sure. I just know what's on IMDb. On IMDb, it says 2015.
Well, yeah, okay. So, yeah, it was after we finished. I think it was right after we finished. Because we had wrapped up in December, and then that shot in February. That's all I remember. So that would have been 2014, which means they would have been in editing for a while. And so there was some tension on set because of the pressure that Mickey was under, and, you know, the ground rules that were previously established were now completely upside down because, you know, the chemistry that we were all expecting to work with that we had already shot on day one was just overturned. And so that made it really rough on her. And, you know, as actors, you know, you're trying to do your bit, and suddenly everything's turned upside down. But, you know, it was definitely an interesting time. That's how I met Will. And then I remember when we wrapped, we stayed there that one night, and then I left like the middle of the night or early next morning, and he was still groggy, and I made sure to wake him up and say, yo, I hope to see you again sometime, bro. Because, I don't know, Will just struck me as like the most earnest, hardworking, one of the most hardworking guys I've ever met, and just, I mean, I'd wish the best for him because it just, I don't know, I had never met pretty much anybody except Jay and Mickey before, but I don't know, just, he just sort of struck me as somebody who's really sincere and just works his butt off.
Yeah, he actually does. I mean, from what I've seen and read about him, because I don't know him that well myself, but from what I've seen about him and read about him and what he said when he was on my show, he works his butt off and does his best.
Yeah, I feel particularly bad because I've never actually seen any of his productions, but I just know how enthusiastic he is. And if there's anything that I know, it's that enthusiasm breeds enthusiasm, you know, and I really admire people who have that level of energy they bring to it. And I know he's got a lot of self-deprecation going on, and, you know, who doesn't? But,
yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter to me what it is he's doing, as long as he's doing it. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, exactly. I know what you mean. Okay, so now you've been an actor, and now you've talked about how you like all the stuff that goes on, the boom guy and the yelling action and all that stuff. And now you've done lots of stunts. Now on IMDb, they've only got 3 on there, but Will said that you've done lots. And so I'm going to assume that he's right, because I know IMDb sometimes leaves lots of stuff out. So do you like doing the stunts better, or do you like acting better, or do you love both of them the same?
I prefer acting because stunts, my experience with stunts has been overwhelmingly in China. Some in Hong Kong, a tiny, tiny bit in Hong Kong, but overwhelmingly in China. And the stunt action choreography world there is, it's hard to, I mean, I can try to explain it. I don't know if I would do it justice, but I really can't compare it to the U.S. because I've never done, you know, like a proper Hollywood feature. I did one tiny little, you know, I helped out with some action and I took a fall for Perils of Posting. But, mm-hmm. And then, you know, there was Jay's first feature, but, you know, I tend to play, since my expertise, my training is in Kung Fu, although I only have those credits in the stunts, I end up doing stunts as part of my character. So I don't have the credit for that. I just do the stunt. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I understand.
So I like the acting. It's just that the stunts, it brings like a whole nother layer to the complexity of making things work.
Now, one thing that I wanted to ask you, because now Will had mentioned this too. I was probably going to ask you anyway, but he wanted me to ask you how this whole COVID thing is affecting you and your career.
Oh. That's...
Take your
time. I'm not sure that's really a straightforward question. I mean, like, I don't think I'm going to give you the answer you're expecting, because I had more or less planned to get out of film and acting and stuff like that before COVID even hit. Because, like I said, the original plan was to go work on some projects, and for, like, I was expecting maybe a year, tops 2, and it ended up being, you know, darn near 20 years. And my background was in engineering, and I'd spent so much time switching back and forth between the U.S. and China and Hong Kong that, you know, at some point you have to draw the line and say, I got to stay in one place. And so I had more or less decided that this year, I know my father was trying to bootstrap another film because it's directly involved with Wing Chun, with Kung Fu, but you know what we do, but isn't. It's before the period of time for Ip Man, and so I figured that project has been backburnered for years, and he's just been trying to get off the ground for years, and so I figured we were expecting to get it going middle of this year, and I wanted to get that done and then just be done with it, you know, and just move into something else and just get my life started somewhere else. So COVID, the only way that COVID really affected things is that now the horizon for that is who knows when. So it's still basically, I'm just on hiatus.
So kind of basically COVID itself really hasn't affected your career, so to speak, is kind of what you're saying. Is that right?
It's put a, I would say, probably a one-year pause on my career.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Because you're still working on that Ip Man, the, what, the fourth one?
No, that's done. That's on Netflix now.
Oh, okay. See, I'm just going by what's on IMDb, and it, well, it doesn't say whether it's finished or not. It just has it on there. I didn't know that. I'll have to look for it.
Yeah,
thanks for telling
it's released just like a week or so ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, yeah. I got some messages from college friends. They were like, whoa, I was watching this with my kid, and I'm like, whoa, there's Darren Leung.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
No, that's really cool that you got it that way. You were probably like, what? So I know that you're, like, not really into films now. Like, well, maybe you are, but as far as being in the business. But I did want to talk a little bit more about, you know, what you've done, because you've done translations for
lots of
movies.
Yeah.
And you did, like, subtitles, your dialogue translator. Now, is that something that you wanted to do, or you just kind of fell into that?
Got to make some money, right?
Right.
If I had the choice, I would do some. I would rather be doing, like, voiceover work. That would be ideal. Then you don't have to do anything except read. But next to that would be subtitle translation. Unfortunately, it doesn't tend to pay very well, depending on the project you're given and, you know, how much of a budget they have. So a lot of the work that I've done was through one company. Their budget's fairly limited, but the work is a bit easier. It's in Cantonese. So Cantonese is, technically, it's my first language, not my best. So there's a lot of subtext in Cantonese dialogue that doesn't come through in, I should say, that may or may not come through in different people's translations. So I first got into it because of working with Karwai, and he, for Grandmasters, had hired Linda Javen, and Linda Javen has done umpteen more subtitles and translations than I have, and she spent, you know, many, many years in China. She's based out of Australia, and she is Chen Kaige's, you know, Chen Kaige's the director for Farewell My Concubine and a bunch of other movies, but she's his go-to translator. So Karwai had hired her for the Grandmaster, and Grandmaster had come out first in Beijing, China, and then in Hong Kong. And so Linda had already handled the subtitles for that because she was on set for a lot of the time and she was there for a lot of the editing. But then when we turned around and we made another edit for Berlin Film Festival in 2013. She had, her contract was already up, and Karwai wanted to make some edits. And ask me to help out because being an American and having Cantonese and Mandarin under my belt, he wanted me to help out.
Mm-hmm.
So I first checked with Linda because you don't want to, you know, that's just professional courtesy. You have to make sure that you're not stepping on another translator's work.
Right.
And so we agreed. She was very gracious. She said, sure, absolutely. And as long as you touch base with me with all the changes that you're making, and, you know, without you know, taking money out of my pocket or anything, which actually I didn't receive any money for it, but she was tagged along to make sure that she was okay with all the translations. And that was really my start for translation work. And I got to say, it was a hell of a start because it was at that time when we were editing, when they were cutting the film in Thailand, that we were there basically all day, every day, for a week solid, 10 days. I went back to my hotel room once during that time and, you know, to sleep one time, and the rest of the time I was sleeping on the couches. And Karwai broke down the story for me and the subtext and the plot and everything. You never hear him talk about his movies in depth, but because he needed to get certain ideas out, he had to tell me what was up. So it was just amazing just to hear, to find out finally after spending years on this project, to hear him actually tell you how much effort he put into researching, thinking about the story, thinking about the characters, and then the whole scope of the movie and the themes of the movie, so that we could boil it back down and try to and put it in the subtitles. And so when we did the subtitles for it, we had to do, and I'm sorry if I'm veering off from, you know, doing the others, talking about, you know, all the other subtitles I've done, but this was sort of the biggest moment because, you know, once he explained all this stuff, we had to distill things down, and generally subtitlers, translators tend to encapsulate what was said in as short a form as possible without losing too much, because you're going to lose something in your
right.
translation, because there's only so many characters on the screen that you can read within 2 seconds.
Now, right.
My understanding is that the baseline, not the baseline, the minimum amount of time that you should give people to read is about 2 seconds. And there's a certain number of characters you're traditionally supposed to be able to fit on the screen at one time. So I've tended to stretch that because I would say Linda's got a, because she's a writer, she has a better command of the language than I do as a writer, and so she can encapsulate things in very elegant ways that I can't.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend to skew towards adding, you know, sort of the flavor of Cantonese. So for the Grandmasters, it really wasn't, it was less me and more me interfacing between Karwai and Linda and sort of helping grease the wheels of understanding of the subtext and all that sort of thing that he wanted to get across. Unfortunately, a lot of the things that we translated was neither Linda's style nor my style, because you could translate something directly as the actual meaning of the line being spoken, or you could
mm-hmm.
translate, you know, sort of essence-wise. But neither of those were satisfactory to Karwai. He decided that he wanted to translate the subtext and just throw it on the screen, because there was so much historical depth and politics and, you know, other information that you can't get even if you have the translation. So you better just throw
right.
the subtext on there. So some people would complain, like, what? They're not even saying what they're saying. You know, there are certain scenes that were in the Chinese edit where there's this older master and a sort of younger brother master, are in this sort of dark, cavernous kitchen over a fire, and he's cooking a pot of what he calls snake stew. And so if you say that to the Chinese audience, the more erudite of them will get it, that, oh, well, snake stew, you have to cook it a really long time, and it's boiling, and it's something that's been brewing for a while, and it's coming to a head. But no matter how you translate that, it doesn't really work in English, even if you throw the subtext out, up on the screen. So I think we ended up cutting that for the American version and then having to move that idea either as an interstitial or, somewhere else in the dialogue. So that became very involved. That was very interesting.
Well, good. I'm glad that you were able to at least enjoy yourself while you were doing all that translating and doing subtitles. And I mean, it sounds really interesting. Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's, I wouldn't say it's terribly interesting all the time. It depends on the work that you're given, because a lot
right.
of the work I've had to do, sometimes, especially the Cantonese ones, they'll throw in song lyrics or poems, or in China I've gotten Taoist scripture or Buddhist scripture, and, I mean, come on. It's so out there that you're just banging your head on the wall thinking of how you could possibly translate this in a way that makes sense to anybody, and you kind of can't. So you have to come up with a compromise. And some people, like, I know Linda loves the challenge, but for me it's just kind of like, did you really have to do that? Did you really have to go to scripture, So it's interesting work. I like it just because it's mobile. You could do it anywhere. But
right,
of that,
yeah.
I would rather act. Yeah.
Except now you're going to go away from acting. But before we talk about that, you did do one producing. I see you have one producer credit for Laura Point. It was a short. What was that like, being a producer?
Oh, that was a Kickstarter sort of producer, You just sort of fund it and you get a producing credit. Yeah.
Oh, well, nothing wrong with that.
Just trying to help somebody else in their dream. And
okay, well, that was a short one then. So
so
what I did want to ask you, since you had already said you were kind of trying to get away from acting, but it would probably be another year. So after that year, or a little bit longer, if it lasts a little bit longer, what is it, do you think, that you want to get into? Do you want to go back to being an engineer, or you want to do something completely different? Or what are you thinking that you want to do?
I think a lot of it just depends on money and opportunity and stability, because I have to find some sort of stability, because I don't see like a long-term future as an actor. If the opportunity is there, if it's a decent opportunity, I have to think about it for acting. If not, just, anything that would play to my strengths as somebody who is multilingual, multicultural. That's why I said voiceover work. I was actually serious about that, because speaking Cantonese and Mandarin, I can do some German, obviously English, accents in English. I've lived in Boston. I came from Virginia. So anything that's creative but that has some stability to it, but pie in the sky, really.
Well, you could, I know you've already realized this, you could get a the term that they use is get a day job, and then when you get these things, you know, haphazardly, like, say, a voiceover work here and a voiceover work there, then at least you're getting regular, steady money from your day job, and then you're getting to do something that you really want to do, which is the voiceover work.
You know, that was the original plan when I came out of college. I thought, I'll do engineering, and then in the evenings, I'll try to get into, like, a local theater production for fun. Not even for money, just for fun. And that didn't quite pan out, so... Sure, if I can get a job, you know, back in engineering, and it wouldn't even be engineering, it would probably be more, the most sensible thing, ideally speaking, would be getting into, like, engineering support or engineering sales, something like that, which is less hard, what I would call hardcore engineering, and more just technical knowledge, and that would require multilingual ability and traveling, because I'm perfectly fine with travel. I've been to all over Asia. You know, obviously I can communicate with the locals in China, Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
So being a liaison in both between an engineering company in the U.S. and, let's say, somebody who makes tools for semiconductor manufacturing, which is what I used to do, that has buyers in China that need that tech support, essentially. So fly me out there, and I can handle the rest. I don't need a translator. I don't need anybody to book me a hotel. I don't need anybody to help me do anything. So sure, that would be fine. Then I could sort of continue this sort of transition, you know? And if I get creative work, fine.
Well, from what you've done so far and from the nice things that Will has to say about you, I would say that you're going to get something. It may not be enough to, you know, like you say, to make a living off of, but I would think that you would be getting enough to at least use your creativeness. And I would hope that for you.
Well, thank you, and I think Will, too. Like I said, he's such a good guy, man. But...
Yeah, he is. He's a good guy.
I feel bad because I was actually thinking of driving up there at some point just to, I don't know, hang out or something, but COVID's put a damper on that. Because he's only a few hours away. I'm sure I could get up there if this wasn't an issue. Pandemic wasn't an issue.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But as far as the opportunities, I don't know. It's not as though I don't have an agent. My agent is essentially the connections that my father has had. And that's a tough thing. It's a sad thing to admit, I think. But it is what it is.
Yeah. Well, not everybody has an agent, and you never know. Sometimes just being on Facebook, and I've discussed this with other guests, because Facebook is actually great for, like, getting, well, maybe not jobs per se, but for getting people together, and then they end up doing things together. Because I've even instigated, for lack of a better word, that myself, where I introduced people to each other and then they end up doing a project together. I mean, it happens. And also on Facebook, if you have something that you did, like say you made a movie and you want people to know about it, you share it on Facebook, your friends share it, then their friends share it, and before you know it, it's all over the world. So that's one nice thing about Facebook.
Yeah, if the stars line up, I guess.
Well, so one reason why I brought that up, because one of the things that I'll be doing once the show is over, because it automatically tapes itself. I just have to wait for the audio to come up, and then once it's up, then I share it. And I will be putting on there that you're looking for voiceover work. and about being multilingual and multicultural. And unless you don't want me to do that, but from what you're saying, I would assume that you would want me to do that.
Certainly, I'd
Am
appreciate
I correct?
That very much. You are correct.
Okay. Yeah, because, I don't know if it will bring about anything, but I do have a lot of filmmaker friends, and maybe the right one will see it, hopefully, that they'll have something for you, and you can get to do one of these things that you like to do. So I hope so. I hope that's the way it works.
It's more than I was hoping for, actually.
Yeah, that's one thing about me is I try to help my friends. I mean, I know we're not friends on Facebook, but when a friend on Facebook, which Will is, and he introduces me to somebody else, which is you or anybody else, and then even if we're not Facebook friends, I still consider them my friends. Because I understand how the whole thing works, that not everybody friends everybody, even though they may be friends in real life. Because I have family members and actual friends in real life that I'm not friends with Facebook for different reasons for each person.
Mm.
Now, like I have a famous uncle, and I'm not going to say what his name is, but one of the reasons why I'm not his friend on Facebook. Well, for one thing, I don't need to be. I have his phone number, his address, and all that stuff. I don't need Facebook. But because if people see my name there and then they associate it with him, and before you know it, because I've had it happen before, and that's why we worked it out to where I wouldn't be on his Facebook. I wouldn't be his friend. I wouldn't be on his I wouldn't be even on his fan page, because what had happened was somebody somehow knew that I was his niece, and they started bugging me to get stuff from him, and I kept telling them, no, I don't do that. And first of all, I don't even know how you knew that. Somehow they found out. However they found out, I don't know, because it's not like I blasted everywhere. I mean, yeah, I mentioned that I have a famous uncle, but I never mentioned his name. And there's like maybe five Facebook friends that know who he is.
Sure.
But it's mainly because they did stuff with him, so they know who he is. But my point in bringing all that up is that even though we're not Facebook friends, it doesn't mean that I can't generate some of this publicity for you.
Well, I appreciate that.
And hopefully, that's quite all right. Hopefully it'll do some good. And we've still got plenty of time, so if there's something else that you want to talk about, like something that you've got going on, it doesn't have to be about movies. It could be about anything. If you've got something on the back burner that you're thinking about doing, or something that you're doing, it could even be something like charity work, or whatever. If you've got something you want to talk about, feel free.
I gotta say, that's for me, that's kind of a tall order, because believe it or not, after all the stuff that I've just spewed at you, I'm not much of a promoter for myself, so I don't generally like to talk about myself. But I will talk once you're asking me questions. So probably a terrible interviewee.
No, not a terrible interviewee. No, there are lots of people that, because I know that my style isn't the same as other interviewers, because I have like a laid-back style, and I do have questions, because I did ask you some questions, but then other times I just like throw out a general comment and then have the people embellish on whatever it was that I said, and usually it works out, but it doesn't work with everybody. So I have to, whenever I am doing my interviews, I just have to go according to whatever my interviewee feels like doing. So now that I know that you don't want to do that kind of thing, then I can just ask you specific questions. Like, say, if it did work out that somebody wanted you for something, would you, like, say, a horror movie, because lots of my filmmaker friends are horror filmmakers, would you be interested... It's a question. Would you be interested in doing anything with a horror movie?
I am interested in working with genuine people like Will, people
mm-hmm.
who are no BS, you know? Even
right.
if they're doing something low budget, I don't care how campy or whatever. If somebody is genuine, they're authentic people who... are not trying to pull your chain, I'm interested.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter to me, you know, what the result is. As long as you're being good to each other, you're good to me, I'm good to you, is my motto. And actually, I don't know if this is an awkward way to wrap things back a little bit when you were talking about how you interview and sort of more laid back, but... as I was working today, I realized that a lot of stress happens in my psyche when you're talking to somebody whose only reason to converse with you is to get their point across, and they don't really care what you say, or they can't hear you, or pretend not to hear you, or they can't be bothered to listen to what you have to say. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
And so...
I know quite a few people.
That's why I feel it's very easy to talk to you, because...
Oh, thank you.
And despite the lag in the phone line, I'd sort of had an expectation of that just from listening to your interview with Will.
Yeah, it's Blog Talk Radio, actually.
Yeah, there you go. It's not necessarily, you know, it doesn't have to be on a blog talk. It doesn't have to be on, like, a serious conversation. It's for me, it's something that's, I could say, triggers. You know, you could talk to somebody, and they're just talking at you. And
yeah,
on paper, objectively, we all know that that's a bad thing, but I don't know that I've really paid attention before to how obvious it can be. As long as you pay attention to it, that it happens. And there's no, you know, there's no back and forth. And so, you know, you can have somebody who's totally animated with what they're talking about, and they want to get their point across, and that's fine. Or, you know, if they're your boss and they're telling you what to do, that's fine too. But there has to be a two-way communication, and that, I think, it's not mutually exclusive to people who are genuine, but I think that is a big part of it. Somebody who is genuine, who is genuinely interested in you
mm-hmm.
and what you have to bring to the table, that gives you as a person a lot of value. And that just, you know, it's like, to me, it's a human need to feel valued.
Yes.
In that way. And, you know, the more I think about that, the more value it holds for me. And so that's why I say it doesn't matter what the project is, as long as everybody's on the up and up and nobody's trying to screw anybody over kind of deal, then we can all be friends and I'm happy.
Yeah, that's really the only kind of filmmakers that I know, because, well, I shouldn't say they're the only ones that I know. I may know of other ones that are the bad kind, but
yeah.
I don't stay friends with them once I find out they're the bad kind. But,
there you go.
Right now, I know who are the good ones and who are the bad ones, and I've been friends with some of them for many, many years, and we even have each other's phone numbers, and I mean beyond calling for this show, that I had their phone numbers for years, some of these people. But because I can throw out some names, and give you a rough idea of some of the people that you might think about if they do offer you anything, because I know they're good. Joel D. Weinkoop, I'm sure you've probably even heard of him. He's like the king of the B-horror movies. And, of course, Will Devakas, whom you already know. And Dave Castelloni, he makes, well, they're low budget because he doesn't have a lot of money to work with. But one of his movies that I mentioned with another guest was Backwoods Marcy. And in this film, it's, yeah, there's somebody doing something to somebody, but usually it's a man that's doing stuff to women, raping them, cutting them up, torturing them, and stuff like that. And then this one, it's a woman that's doing it to a man, including the raping. Yeah. So, I mean, not that I like that to be done. It's just that, well, they're always doing stuff to women. Do something to a man for a change. And so that's what it is, actually. And you actually don't even care that he's getting stuff done to him because he's a real creep. Now, there's a few other ones. There's Tim Ritter. He's, you know, really above board. Dustin Hubbard and Phil Herman. You may have heard of him. And he has lots of connections. So if you ever, in fact, Phil Herman, without even knowing you, because I had mentioned that you were going to be on the show, and he said, oh, well, give me a minute. And he looked you up, and he was, like, really impressed at the things you were doing. Oh. And so he shared the link for your show and was telling people to listen to the show. So, see, you've already got maybe not a friend, but you've got somebody who doesn't even know you already sharing something for you. Oh, see?
That's awesome.
And he's a really good guy.
I can't tell you how you
did that. And he's a really good guy too. So,
awesome.
And he helps out his friends. So I probably could like introduce you on Facebook, and then you can friend each other, and you never know, it might work out. But
sure.
Yeah, I've got so many filmmaker friends that. There's another one, Kyle Hester. I haven't had him on the show yet, but he's in the process of making a movie as well. And it's not really low budget, but that's one reason why it's taken a long time, because he's trying to make it better than a low budget movie would be. And that's what happens sometimes, you know. That if you want the movie to be a little bit better and you want to spend some time on it and some money, and it might take you 4 or 5 years to make a film. And even with a low-budget film, it could take 4 to 5 years to make a film.
Right.
Because, you know, it just depends. So let me tell you briefly, because we've all this talk had brought us down to 6 minutes. So that worked out really good. Joel D. Weinkoop, so much love, Joel, since I'm mentioning him. He has this thing, I mean, it's almost all wrapped and everything, but just because we had mentioned COVID. So the COVID inspired him, like it has a lot of filmmakers, to make a film that's specifically shot around the whole, like, COVID experience. So he's making this film, and everything's almost done, but people would not phone in, but they would send him by video or whatever their performances, and then he would put it into the movie. And then if they did do any filming, they would make sure they were like 20 feet apart, and when they weren't on film in front of the camera, they would have the masks on, everything. So everything was the way everything should be for COVID, and it's called the Craiglon Incident. So you may want to check that out. And I might introduce you to him, too, over over Facebook, because he's a really nice guy. Him and his wife, Kathy Holzebrook Weinkoop, much love to you, Kathy, and they do a lot of stuff together, and they're like two of the nicest people in the industry. And they're good to the people that they work with. They're nice to everybody. I mean, yeah, they want you to do your job if you're working for them, but they don't treat you like crap or, oh, you're just an actor. They're not like that because they're used to doing everything themselves because they're those indie filmmakers that they do the acting and producing and cinematography and the casting director. And in one film, I think Kathy did like 16 different things in one movie. So...
Yeah.
So that's the type of people they are. So I'll see about getting you introduced to them, and I'll make sure that I share all this. And now we've got we've got 4 minutes. So what is the best way, like say if people wanted to hire you or just a friend you on Facebook, what would be the best way for them to get a hold of you?
I would say probably just a message on Facebook that I can reply to and shoot more personal details as necessary. You already have my profile on Facebook, but it's fairly easy to remember. I think it's facebook.com/LEUNG1. Should be my profile.
Yeah, it is, because I just now brought it up, and that's what it is, LEUNG1. So that,
yep.
If anybody wants to speak to my guest, just shoot him a Facebook message and give him a few details about why you're contacting him, and maybe you can give him a job. I'm sorry. I hope that didn't sound as bad as what I thought it did.
It is what it is.
Well,
it sounds
let me
fine.
Just
I appreciate
just,
the effort.
I didn't embarrass you by saying that, did I?
I'm sorry?
I didn't embarrass you by saying that, did I?
Oh, no. Certainly not.
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to make sure. Yeah.
The only
okay,
thing
so there's only
I'm embarrassed by is if somebody messages me and I'm just like, okay, so who is this person? And because not everybody that, you know, like maybe the people that you say are nice aren't necessarily the people who are messaging me. So I've never had to deal with like an inundation of messages. Not that I would expect any, but there's that sort of apprehension.
Right. Oh, that's understandable because I get people sending me messages that, like, they're weird stuff. And this one, she sends me, she actually is an actress, and she sends me this thing saying that she saw that Kathy said that I was looking for females to be on the show because I'm getting, a lot of guys. Not that there's anything wrong with guys, but, you know, there's a lot of women in the industry. And so she said that she was interested. She sent me the thing, and so then I wrote her back and said, well, sure. And then it's like she never answers my messages. So, okay, well, you can't be that interested then. So whatever. Maybe she's just flighty. I don't know. But my point is that I understand what you mean.
Yeah.
So there's only like
I'm
a
sure
minute
you,
left,
you
so I
do.
Can
–
I can even end the show early if I want to. It's just that if you go over, they have a tendency to, like, just cut you off in the middle of the sentence.
Oh, okay.
So is there anything that you want to say in closing?
I don't know. As it turns out, there was a project that I had in mind that I wanted to do for years. I wouldn't say a horror movie, but sort of a thriller based in Hong Kong, but I plan to write the script for that, or at least the story for that, and work on it with, I have one or two people in mind, but as far as shooting for the moon, that would be one of the things. Other than that, not really.
Oh, well, I hope that works out for you. And Darren Leung, hopefully I pronounce it right, or at least close, thank you for being on the show. I appreciate it, and I hope you have a good night.
Thank you very much, and good night to you as well.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.